Welcome to another episode of the RAG podcast. And for those of you who don't know, the RAG stands for Recruitment Agency Growth. Since early 2019, I've been interviewing the most successful and innovative recruitment owners to learn how they rose to the top of their game. In season 7, I'm going to be having raw, authentic, and insightful conversations with agency owners, entrepreneurs, leaders, people across the industry. And I want to be learning about their ambitions, what's happening behind the scenes in their agencies today, and their plans to navigate difficult market conditions. I'll be bringing you the latest and greatest recruitment stories every single week on Wednesdays at noon across multiple platforms. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the RAG podcast. On this week's show, I'm joined by an old client of mine, Paul Smith. Paul is the Managing Director of Deploy Recruitment, a specialist infrastructure and technology recruitment business, heavily weighted in the rail sector. Paul joined the business, or started the recruitment side of this business, just over 10 years ago. But only a year ago, he completed the MBO to buy out his original partners and take full ownership of the company. Now, so many recruitment founders in the modern day go into partnership with other people, whether it be business partners or back office providers, solutions, investors. And so many get to a point when a little bit down the line, it just doesn't feel like the right fit anymore. And Paul explains why he felt like he needed to buy the company himself, the risks that are attached to that, both professionally and personally, and how he did it. We break it right down. And then we talk about what he's felt like since taking ownership and the future he has in front of him. A super honest guy. You know, he does not mince his words. That's what I love about Paul. But for anyone who's thinking about either selling to their employees as an MBO or completing an MBO in the future or buying out a business partner, then you've got to listen to this episode. Without further ado, Paul, welcome to the RAG podcast.
Thanks, Sean. It's nice to see you today. Pleasure as always. Oh,
no, great to have you on.
Thank you.
We've been talking about this for a while. My fault for not booking this in earlier, but we're finally here. I'm well, mate. I say I'm well. I feel ill, but apart from that, everything else is pretty good. What about you? How are you on this pretty miserable March day where I am?
I'm pretty good, yeah. Our new office, we've just taken some more space in Wellingarden City for expansion, which is great news. Something you might not have noticed, which I've not put anything about actually, is that I've no more glasses.
I have noticed that actually. I didn't, now that you've said it, have you just had the laser?
Yeah, I had the old laser eye treatment first week of January. So just trying to get used to not wearing glasses after, 20 plus years. So that's interesting.
Wow, how good has it been?
It's fantastic. Really, I cannot highly recommend it enough. It's a game changer, absolute game changer. And I think the only way you can describe it is probably watching Die Hard 1 as it was filmed in the 80s and then going blurry for about 30 seconds and then going to Die Hard 5 in HD. And it's just, it's great. It puts a smile on my face, if that makes sense. So, all positive and all good at the moment.
That's brilliant. My mate, one of my best mates who I lived with in 2010, he had it done. And this is a long time ago now, obviously. And he's still rock solid. Like, he's kept on for 14 years. He's still got 20/20 vision, he says. And he's happy as Larry. So long may that continue 100%. For you, mate.
Thank you.
I'm all right. My eyes are pretty good. I do have glasses for, like, I'm told to use them when I'm on my screen, which I don't very often do, but I'm pretty good. Paul, people might not know you. I've done a brief introduction, so let's give me the bird's eye. Like, if we're going to look at Deploy from above, who are you? Where are you based? How many people? What do you do? That kind of stuff, and then we'll tell the story in the detail later.
Okay, so I'm Paul Smith, the managing director and chief of tea and coffee in the business. We are 32 heads now. Based in Wellingarden City, East Croydon, and Boredom, which is down in Hampshire. We're an infrastructure and technology business, and we service blue collar, white collar, professional technical, we want to call it, in the UK, Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, and America at the moment.
Wow. So you've got a US footprint as well?
Yes, we have.
And when you say infrastructure and technology, what do you mean by that?
So our business was built around the railway industry, where we're doing contingent labour. So from our turnover of 20 million, 90% currently would be in the rail market space within the blue and white collar environment.
Yeah.
What that means is we're not the guys who obviously delay your trains. We don't deal with trains. We stay away from those. We're the ones who fix your infrastructure. So when people ask what do we do as a business, the best way of putting it is anything that's got cable and related services connected to that. So what that means is everything from the digging of the tracks and the side of the tracks in the troughs to lay the cables to connect it to substations, overhead lines, telecoms, signaling, etc. And that's what we do.
Right.
And then as a business, what we've done is taken that methodology and expanded it into other related industries. So as I said, telecoms, but more for utilities, highways, data centers. And then from the technology point of view, what then we look at and then go, okay, you've got SCADA, you've got Primavera planning, you've got all the software related technologies that go with how these projects are planned and delivered.
Right. So that makes sense. Yeah. Infrastructure started with rail, but then gone on land into different areas, etc. And it is so scalable. If you think about, because you can take the same thing into different sectors, but you can also take it into different territories, right? You could keep growing.
100%.
Because every country's got the same basic infrastructures, right?
Yeah.
And there always seems to be maintenance happening and problems. There's always something going on in that, especially in the railway. There's always something going on.
Yeah, look, technology's moving as quick as the industry can. And I think where I'm quite boring on these things, it's when you actually deep dive into how things are put together. Like Crossrail, that was obviously started planning, what, 20 years ago? So the small thing like on telecoms, we're at 5G now, right? Phones are super fast. You've got your data, your technology, yeah. Everything else like that. When that project was put together, it was only priced at doing 3G. So 3G has only just gone into Crossrail.
Really?
Wow. So they have to then reapply, update, retender, and then start moving through the technology gaps. Because how do you fluidly price a project as technology moves? It's too quick.
So really, they're going to look at building 5G, and by the time they're in, we'll be on 7G or whatever. So you'll always have work to do.
There's always lags
to build.
There's always lags. And let's be fair, when was the last time, if you got on the train last time, is the Wi-Fi consistent? Never.
It's horrific. I was literally whinging about it. I was on the train, now East Midlands Railway from Sheffield to London for me. You can't get a consistent signal. And it's not even just the Wi-Fi. It's the... Suddenly your phones don't work. Why does it interrupt like EE on those lines?
So because I think when I spoke to someone about it, they're going to have to put a small antenna. I think it's every 10 feet along the side of the track to get a consistency of signal. Could you imagine the scale of trying to do that across the whole country?
But why though? Surely it's like being in a car on a motorway. Like, why is it any different? I don't get it. Like, why is it?
I can't answer that question. I can't answer that question.
Come on, Paul.
I'm really sorry, Sean. I can't answer that one. But that's the sort of challenges you're finding. But then, you know, in walking around the city, you say 5G on your phone, but you can't get a signal.
Yeah.
I think we can take photos from Mars, but I can't send a selfie to a friend.
Yeah, it's nuts. And it really, I think it's one thing in life that really pisses people off. The lack of, when technology fails, people lose their, like my stepdaughter this morning playing bloody Roblox. And I've got this little black hole in my house. This one little corner that if you sit in it, doesn't matter what Wi-Fi is running. Well, she always likes the chair, but she gets so annoyed that her phone, I'm like, just relax and move.
Well, when we come offline, I'll bore you through. How you get rid of that black spot. I'll talk to you about that. But again, you know, we're going to things like electric vehicles. We were having this conversation. I'm a big advocate for going full electric. I know a lot of people are still quite apprehensive. And they were talking about, obviously, range anxiety. And I said, look, as kids, when you went on a long journey with your parents, you get the AA roadmap out. And the first thing you're ticking off on the list is where the service stations are. To fuel up and have lunch. We're so lazy because it got everywhere and so easy. People don't want to think to plan ahead.
No, I've got a mini electric. It's got like 100 miles on it. So I have to really plan where I like it. I enjoy it. And you 15 minutes to get to 80% charge. I mean, you get a coffee, you check your emails, you're off again.
100%.
It's not as fast as a petrol station, but I like it. I've got no issue with it.
It becomes more of a, it makes you take breaks. Whereas if you're driving with a very long range on your car, you might drive for 6 hours solid without a break, which is actually quite dangerous.
It's not good. Yeah, massively dangerous. Well, Paul, we could talk about this shit forever.
I can bore you forever on this stuff, Sean.
No, I mean, look, I like this stuff. Electric vehicles is definitely on my topics of interest. But tell us about your journey, because you didn't join Deployers like the, you know, the founder. You didn't start the business, but you are the MD, the main shareholder, I believe, and you've got to that level. So you joined the business just over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What was going on? What were you doing before, and why did you join the business?
How far do you want to go back, Sean?
Let's just keep to the recruitment side of you. I don't need the day in, day out, year in, year out, but like how long were you in the industry before and why did you join Deploy?
So I was at a very large, successful agency for just over 10 years. I think it was a chance meeting of minds. Someone had left the business to go over to Deploy to run their construction arm, which was very successful, and said, look, they're looking to get into the railway. So I was like, okay. I think I got to the point where you get a little bit fed up of your ideas not being listened to. And probably listening to what we've just been discussing, I'm not very good at stopping, sitting still. I like to move forwards. I like to see how the future's looking quite quickly and try and plan 5 years ahead of where we're going to be and where the curve is. And I started thinking, and I thought, you know what? It's either kind of now or never. I could sit there and continue being successful where I was, keep taking the money, or take the risk and do something for myself. Had meetings with the owners of the rest of the group. They're not recruitment as a business. They're principal contractors in the demolition industry, subterranean basements for the kind of rich and mega rich in London. And with my industries, we're very compliance heavy and very paperwork led. And you have to have a lot of certification and qualifications to be able to play in our industry, which is not cheap. Mm-hmm. So you kind of take the view, do you take money and set up on your own? Or do you go into somewhere that can offer you the full paperwork trail and package of that to get yourself in and going?
So they weren't a recruitment company, but they were in the industry that you served and they had all the back office.
No, not at all. But they had, from a point of view, they had a full health and safety business. They had full quality management, every ISO under the sun. They could write the ISOs on my behalf. So walking through the door, the biggest thing you have when you're starting your own business is what is going to allow clients to step you in really quickly. And what people probably don't look at and realize at the time on certain industries you want to work in, it's the quality of your management systems, the processes and procedure that actually gets you over the line. So I knew from day one, no guarantees, but I knew of every process, procedure and ISO that I needed for the industry, there'd be no box I couldn't tick on a supply chain questionnaire.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it meant I had a head start. A real head start, because I wasn't on the back foot. I was on the front foot from the day I walked through the door.
So paint the picture then of what was day one like. Was it just you or did you build a team?
I brought Rod Lanigan over, who was my first employee, and he's still here today. I think he's had a few break. Awesome. I think we had a few breakdowns of midlife crisis between us in between that journey. Again, when you're starting up, you've got to be very careful about your restrictive covenants, because if you are good at your job, people are going to look at you and see what you're doing. And it's, as we found on social media world and LinkedIn, etc., you can quickly see what people are up to and what they're not up to. So me and Rod started, and we moved offices out of the group straight away to Euston Station. As a building that looks at the station itself. So you can see when people are coming in and out of the station. So for the first year with the team we brought in, and this sounds probably quite very old school, we were watching the station to see clients walk out.
Really?
So I've never seen people run so fast downstairs, three flights of stairs, four flights of stairs, just to get to find the client.
Wow. How would you know, though, like, they were coming into Houston?
You look at where your clients are based, and if they're traveling by train, you know likelihood of where they're going to be. Yeah. We had Network Rails, one of their main offices to our right, who was obviously their client.
Yeah.
And we knew in there, just outside of Houston, they had offices in King's Cross and head offices probably in that surrounding areas. So they'd either come out for a cigarette when they got off the train before they got on the tube, or they'd be stumbling out of a bar with the client, unofficially, or having lunches in the pubs and bars right outside. So we knew we had a good ability to find people if we needed to, clients-wise.
Yeah.
And obviously, we couldn't talk to them potentially over the phone. We couldn't send them emails because we had the covenants, but we can run into them.
Yeah.
So we were.
So you did that.
We did that. Yeah, we literally were. And one of our guys who was with us at the time was quite a smoker. And to watch him run down three flights of stairs, we used to time them. It was very funny. So we go, right, clients there, go and get them. And we're like, let's see how long it takes him today. He got faster.
So you'd be knackered. You'd be running down the stairs in a suit, facing a client, just to say, as if you've naturally bumped into them. Or would you have like a reason?
It's funny.
Would you be like, look, I want to talk to you about this?
No, just literally bump into them. Funny, right?
Yeah. It, probably the first time. If it happens like a third time to the same guy, he must be like...
But they know, obviously, the nice thing is our industry is very broad but very small. We all, at some point or another, know each other. I mean, I've been 23 years now in this market space, or 22 years. So we're very fortunate to be in a position of being quite well-known across the patch. But it's good fun, you know. You look at recruitment these days, and they always say, "What's your unique selling point?" Well, ours is we could run down three flights of stairs in under a minute. That was.
We will find you.
We will find you.
This is how you know we're good recruiters. This is how we can guarantee we'll find your talent. We'll find you, on any given day, without a sat nav. We will find you. That's fucking scary. It should be called taken recruitment.
But that's how we started.
In Liam Neeson, your chairman.
Yeah, so that's how it started out. And then we were very lucky to grow. I think we went from, it was 1 to 4 to 9 million in the first 3 years. So it was rapid growth. But the business was set up with two principles. It was set up on compliance and paying people properly. That's the very two core. And it still is the same today.
Is that such a big issue in your space then? Is that a big like classic error recruiters make, because they don't get those two things right?
Yeah, so the you know, paying people on time is the biggest issue in blue collar temp recruitment. It really, really is, because you've got such a short window of time sometimes of getting timesheets through to process. And as you scale, that's where the problems come in. Really is. And I think at certain points I was taking out additional personal loans on a Friday to pay our staff, because the timesheets weren't coming in quick enough. But I had a reputation to withhold and a promise I made to people that come across to trust us from a startup. So
what was the relationship like with the business that was already deployed? Like, well, how did that?
So they were basically, there was a really, I think what attracted me at the time was there was three really good people in the business. And I walked through the door and I sit there and I was like, going, they're not doing very much. I don't get it. I don't understand what is going on in here. It's really quiet all day. But I had nearly 400 people working from consistently day to day on construction sites. And, you know, it was a testament that they did a fantastic job. So you kind of look at things and go, there's something here. And from the group's point of view, you can see from the chairman down, from Paul Ford to Ashley Griffiths, they knew what they were doing. They knew what they had and they were looking to achieve. And when I joined them as a group of companies, I think we were doing 20 million. And then when I did the buyout just over a year and a bit ago, it was 120 million turnover group. That's in the 10 years I was there. So, right. You know, it was an incredibly interesting place to be. And like I say, where they weren't in recruitment per se, we were obviously supplying internally to the projects they had won. A lot of the guys that the other guys had out when I joined was all external business. So you can see if you get those two merged correctly, you could be looking at 500-600 people out potentially a day, which is exciting, right?
And did you charge them the normal rates you'd charge anyone else?
So
if you did supply
We had, so from an internal point of view, there was agreements in place on fixed margins. So it gave them the ability for flex. Because again, ultimately, when the difficult thing about running internal businesses is that you think it's a given. And when the other guys left and I took over construction and the rail parts, I made the purpose that we'd keep them as a client, not as a internal company, which then gives you a different mindset on how you deal with people. So if you treat them as family, you take the proverbial and you can take the piss sometimes. Whereas if you keep them as a separation, you have to keep to what you said you're going to do.
Yeah.
You can't take advantage.
So they were more a contracting consultancy then, were they? Where they would go and win big projects of work?
Yeah, so two projects. So the other thing they had was they had 21 out of 23 boroughs in London for dangerous structures. So what that means is, if anything, from a giant crack in a building to an unexploded World War II bomb to a building falling down or, unfortunately, a major fire, they will be called in to deal with that. And unfortunately, probably the one project that would be known, unfortunately, is Grenfell Tower. So the team from the contracting side were probably one of the first on the scene, sadly, when that was obviously when that incident happened.
Yeah.
And respectfully, they are still on the project today, doing a really good job. And that's, regardless of the buyout or not, their standards are always kept and still are kept really high on whatever they do as a group. And that gave me confidence when joining that they were very strict to the rules on procedure and process. And within the rail industry, when you're dealing with a massive train coming at you at 100 miles an hour at some points, you need to have your process and procedures in place at just in case on the what ifs.
Yeah. So they had an infrastructure based contracting firm with customers and projects, but they weren't in the rail space.
No rail space at all. So it was completely from scratch. It was blind faith, Sean. It was
so they were giving you the back in, but you were then taking your network and opening it in that way. And did you split it where you would still support their projects even though it was non-rail?
Because so at the time there was only a team in place for that, and then as it grew and other people left, I then took over all parties of that, and then we put a team in to service them while looking at some of the rail stuff. So a lot of it's interchangeable skills. So from a from a telehandler through to a ground worker to a carpenter, the only difference is on the construction side, you'd have a CSCS ticket, which is your competency for there. And on the rail, you'd have a PTS ticket, personal track safety, to allow you to go onto the network.
Yeah.
So you put A and B together, there isn't that much difference other than a competency. So if you had decent guys on one, you could then employ them on the other, because on the railway, most of the works, as most people get frustrated with, is on a weekend. So, I mean, you can give guys midweek work and then top them up with additional shifts at the weekend, which then kept them very happy.
Yeah. Yeah, but, well, financially, I'm sure it'd be pretty hard work, that, doing all week and then going out and missing your family on the weekend.
We work we're on the rail, we work 365 days. There is no break.
Is that the recruitment side as well?
24/7, 365.
Wow. How does that work? Because one of my team used to work in logistic recruitment for DHL and stuff, and she had to have an overnight phone, and she'd have to get up at 2 a.m. and
in case.
Tell, how does that work?
I think it's like everything is. It's probably a bit like medical recruitment. Once you're in it, you're in it. It's either how does it work? That's a good question. you hope it doesn't have to work is a good way of putting it, because you've done everything to that point of failure. And if you are getting those calls, they're very rare, because ultimately there's been a problem that needs to be dealt with. So you just have to either, you have to fall in love with the industry.
But you have a certain amount of people every day that are like on call at night, just in case, or is it everyone's on call? How does it logistically
work? We have on call numbers, but then ultimately there'd be someone having, ultimately, regardless of what the call is, if you're the one looking after that client and you're looking after those resources, you're technically the only one who can actually answer that question. So it's about having as much information in one place, sharing that information, and having enough people can answer your questions on your behalf. But it's not easy. It's really not easy. I mean, the amount of films I think I've missed the ending of over the years, you know, I still don't know how Titanic ended.
I'm sure I can tell you that.
But it's what you fall in love with an industry, and then you kind of stick with it.
I'm just thinking, right, so you hire a recruiter and you say to him, look, part of this job is at night, every now and again, occasionally, you're going to get a call and you're going to have to answer it. You're going to have to help. You're going to have to get back on your computer. Yeah. Like, and how often does that actually happen in reality?
Not as often as it used to. The industry has become a lot more organized, a lot more stringent on how resources can be shared. And that's a big thing. Software, we're a lot more competent now that's done. And you have to have agreements between agencies on who you can use. So you're allowed to have one primary. So you could work for me, Sean. And then you're allowed two other sub-sponsors. So that could be two other agencies that can ask permission for your time. But ultimately, we can reject that, because obviously there's a lot of strict rules behind working hours, travel time, and amount of shifts you can do. So it's all a lot of management behind the scenes, which is now, thankfully, all managed by software, rather than before it being, an A3-sized written diary that I'd have to carry around with me on weekends and have massive pockets of paper walking out of nightclubs trying to make phone calls. No word of a lie. The doorman used to just get used to me wandering out, going, you're making some work calls. I'm like, yeah, give me 5 minutes, gentlemen. And you just kind of get on with it. Yeah. It's a hard sell.
So if we go back to the early days, of Deploy then, like you said, it went from 1 to 4 to 9 million. That's revenue, right? That's including all of your contract, your payments. So what does that turn into gross profit in net fee income?
Not in the first few years.
What is the typical margin from turnover to net fee income? Do you know?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I'm not going to lie. I think I'll flip it another way. If someone says to me, you know, what do you do as a business? I say, I run a recruitment business that makes a profit. I don't talk about other numbers, because ultimately turnover is vanity, cash is king. So that makes sense.
It's just understanding, once you pay your contractors, what is actually the business turnover, like the revenue, the gross profit, not the net profit after paying your team, but like if you just take your contractor payments out of 9 million, what's left? It's that kind of question. Because I think
if my clients are watching this or not, or listening to this.
Well, I doubt they will. I think it's mainly other recruiters. Just because, like, look, when I was in recruitment, we had a 25 million turnover, but you know, the net fee income was about 5-6 million, I think, in the business, because a lot of that was contract.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of
that. It's like, cool. Like, that's part of the.
So we probably would have been around on 9 million. Gross profit, you're looking at about 3-3.5. But it's a lot of costs. That's the problem with railways, is that it doesn't matter what the number is, it's all the costs relating to it. So obviously, in simple terms, perm placements are free money because there's no investment of time or obviously cash needed for lending. Contracts, if it's white collar office base, it's transactional. And if you're getting something more technical that needs a competencies, PPE, and you're responsible for their health and safety, then obviously insurances change. Just everything amplifies and costs a lot more money. So when people look at the top line number, it's never related to the bottom. Because ultimately, if I'm saying at the moment I'm doing 90% in blue collar temp, that's costing me a fair lot of money.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm 70s, 80s, and 12 months time, Sean,
yeah,
the business is now doing 50-50 split between permanent recruitment and blue collar temp. I'd rip your arm off.
Yeah.
Because then you're spreading the risk. And then you're obviously from a point of view of as a business, it's a lot more planned rather than a shift here, a shift there, and relying on your clients.
Are you also thinking about payment? Is it all about payment terms as well? Because you've got to pay out your contractors perhaps before you get the money from the client as well. So you've got it's a big cash flow issue, correct. Right?
So yeah, we have to obviously take it from the point of view. We're very lucky. Our lenders are very understanding. They trust us. And again, that comes down to then what type of clients you're taking on. So it's down to credibility, size of client, and then payment terms, as you say. I'll be honest with you, the whole business now is pretty much run through and paid by Amex. All our services, all our processes, anything we can pay on Amex, we put through Amex. Because ultimately, from that point of view, you get your 56 days credit and you get your points. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you must be flying first class wherever you go.
Yes, in certain respects. why not? You've got to use benefits when they're there. Because no one's going to give you anything.
Yeah. You know what? We've been doing similar with our like ad spend and all the things for years. We've still not... I did one flight to LA. I just literally didn't pay for it. Like, I just used my points to get there and back. But I've never done a first class flight. I really want to do it at some point. But then I believe once you do it, you won't want to go back. So I'm almost like, what's the point? Because it'll just ruin my experience of not being able to do it every time.
It's an even better benefit, 100%. But it's not just that. We now offer it to our clients to pay us via Amex or credit cards.
Mm.
Because I think when you talk about USPs and us in as agencies and companies, there's not much between us these days other than service and delivery. So when clients are saying, well, why should we use you? We want 90 days terms. You're going, well, I can't physically offer you that. But what I can offer you is 30 days and an Amex payment, which is giving you 86 days technically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How do you get the Amex? Is it just like a Stripe link that you provide or something like that?
Simple, right?
Clever, isn't it? Yeah, I need to do more of that with our business, to be fair. A message from our sponsor, Vincere. Another of their products is known as Time Temp. This is your complete integrated timesheet workforce management solution. It's pre-built, it's pre-integrated, and it's designed so no matter how much your business grows, you'll be able to keep track of every single worker in one place in your CRM. All the changes inside Vincere will sync with Time Temp and they'll be fed back into your account, automating the entire process with two-way sync from your front to back office. Vincere's Time Temp enables you to create shift schedules, search available workers, shortlist and book assignments in seconds. They'll also allow you to track time, track leave, track expenses within their built-in payroll engine. It's called Door Clock. And then they've also got a mobile app for the on-the-go worker. If, again, you're looking to get more from your CRM, Vincere's Time Temp solution is another tool that enables you to perform more of your business-critical processes in your CRM. Find out if you could use Time Temp via the link in the show notes. Right, let's get back to it. Like you say, most people, we don't actually have that much of a problem. But if there's people that are worried about the cash flow, it's like, well, just pay it on an Amex, pay it back whenever you want to. Just don't worry about paying me. Pay me up front.
Agree to be paid on their first day of their new statement month. Because you're then getting the full value and benefits across the two sides. So yeah, we're always trying to find different ways of working with our customers and different ways of expanding things. So we sell phone lines to our clients now. We sell QR code technology solutions into our clients now. You know, we just try and find the most common sense thing that is not being done at the moment and simplify it at real low cost to them. So I think whereas James Osborne says, getting sticky with your clients, sounds wrong, but we'll go with that. That's the sort of things. Just look at what they're not doing very well or stuff that will make their lives easier, regardless of being on site or processed during the office. So data is a really good one at the moment. Everyone's obviously very shouting about Power BI and everything else like that, but no one actually really knows what it means or what it actually can do.
No.
So again, we've now got Rob Wands, who you've spoken to and met before. He's my director of operations. Yeah, he's now done a level 4 apprenticeship in being a data scientist. Incredible, right?
Wow.
But that's going to take a 2-year process, but that'll allow the business then to start actually giving our clients live data, not just on what we're supplying, but what they're spending.
So you have like a Power BI dashboard for them to see Correct. Everything in real time.
It's quite cool.
Wow.
If you like that sort of stuff.
So what, I use Power BI, so I do. I like data a lot. If we go back a bit, so when did you and how did you take over the business? Because like you say, you've gone in as a partner and you've effectively founded the recruitment side of the business, but it was Correct. Already in existence before as a company. So how did it get to the point of you buying them out? Like, talk us through that. When did you realize it was going to happen? And then what was the process?
I won't lie. The businesses were set up to sell from day one. So it was more timing than anything else. And I was given some advice a long time ago by someone I trust, a guy called Howard Wallace, who's they're actually our accountants now. And he said, Paul, don't grow something you can't afford to buy.
Interesting.
So, and that's it. It was, and that's always stuck with me because ultimately I could have built, and I'm not sitting there saying I held back on anything, but you then start working out your multiples, you start working out how much it's physically going to cost, and you get to a reasonable size and then go, that's not going to happen. So it was out of circumstance, Sean, I'm not going to lie, to making that decision. And you know, lockdown was it. Pre-lockdown, we were at our peak. We had a very large office in central London. It was a 40-head office in Liverpool Street. We were on for our best year, which was about 23 million with a bottom line of 750 after everything, right? Healthy. Our split between blue collar and white collar was getting to 70-30. So I was on the right journey and the right path.
Yeah.
And then obviously COVID happened and a lot of soul searching and circumstance had to happen. The team went from 38 down to eventually 18. We were still paying in excess of £22,000 a month on empty offices.
Crippling, isn't it? How long were you tied in for that?
Until last year.
Horrible.
So it kind of got to a point where it's like, okay, we've gone to a really good high and now everything's gone to a flat line. Our clients are still with us. We were very, very, very grateful that we remained very busy in lockdown. Because of the industries we're in, work had to continue. We still had to operate. We still had to get stuff done.
Yeah.
I've been eternally grateful for the industry and our clients still using us, trust us. And it actually kept, you know, not just us as a business, it kept our contractors being able to afford to pay their bills and afford to keep their families fed and watered. Which, you know, we look and we talk about finances and money and turnover as a business. I think we sometimes forget without the people working for us, we don't have a business. And if they don't have a job, they don't have their own lives and they can't afford to live themselves. And I think that period gave us a kind of a sombering mode and maybe mode, so a sombering period and decisions. And when I looked at what we had coming back into, as you were saying, talking about the offices, when they were being finished the contracts, it was kind of a now or never scenario.
So you saw that profit was obviously down, which means the cost, the valuation of the businesses is lower, but the infrastructure and everything was still there. So you saw an opportunity to go, well, you know, if I can get the business now at a lower price, I can then build it and own it fully, right? And what was the going on for the original business partners that meant that they would allow that, because surely they would have seen that as well.
It scales. They're a contracting business that make a lot of money when they do the jobs very well. It's in their own hands because they're pricing a project, call it 10 million. It's down to them how they deliver that to make their profits. We're obviously a different world where recruitment is very turnover related. It's contract book, and then you're trying to find your margins on staff costs, everything else. So we were never going to hit the kind of expected numbers that they were making. Does that make sense? So when you're comparing the two types of businesses, we were never going to have the expected profitability to what they would ever. The other parts of the business were already going through transition of looking for sale and going in management buyout. So we were actually, I think we were one of the last, we were the last business to do an MBO on.
So they looked at their core business and thought, well, all of the kind of offshoots can go, and then they'll just double down on one area.
And again, if you go back to the original conversation, they weren't in the rail market. But if your focus is not in that particular market space and you're contracting elements and not making money or even winning projects on that side, we're not physically part of their ecosystem. Even though we've collectively tried to make it work, tried to win projects that are not. So we do project-based work alongside recruitment. So we're not purely just a recruitment company. So if the projects are there, but not the size and obviously profitability, you kind of get to the point going, look, we're not, you know, it's square peg round hole scenario. So I think mutually it was always it was always going to happen, whether it be a sale to external or a management buyout from my point of view. It's just the timing and the costs and how much it would have cost behind the scenes.
How much work, if take us back to that time, once you'd come up with the plan and you'd gone, right, well, this is what I think is timing's right. Like what steps did you need to go through to execute that? Because there'll be a lot of people out there thinking about MBOs or even reverse MBOs where they want to be bought out, but I've never been through it. So it's always good to give like a candid approach to what it's really like.
The candid approach is regardless of how happy everyone seems, at some point you're going to get a chink in the armory, that something's going to happen that's going to put one party on the back foot to the other. It's just human nature, Sean, because one person will value it one way of looking at it, and someone like myself will value it differently. So from that point of view, it's how much cost you want to actually put into the process is maybe a good way of putting it. So from my point of view, I had an M&A broker who would come in and obviously do their part to value it. They've had their own valuation team. So then you're trying to negotiate between A and B to try and find some mutual ground. You then have the middle ground then of trying to then talk to the broker, talk to your funders to make sure if this happens, they'll continue to give you that credit line. And then you've got to think about things like really small things. Like if you're banking with, say, Barclays at the moment, because you're part of a bigger, wider group, will Barclays then take you as a single entity? Are you big enough for them? And the answer was no.
Yeah.
So you then have to go through the full process of actually looking at who will actually touch you from day one and why are they going to work with you? Because ultimately you've come from a £100 million group of businesses to starting pretty much from a high risk portfolio again. So it's good fun. And then,
but would you not have had like the recruitment business portfolio, like finances, as an individual asset to review as well, and show that, you know, we have got historical data here. We're not a complete startup, even though we were part of a wider group. We still have our own profit and loss.
So then you've got to step back again and go, well, how much risk do you want to import on yourself personally? How much physical will you put up for this business? How much do you believe in what you're doing? And I think, from talking to other people where I've had these conversations, I don't think people actually get it, Sean. I really don't. And they're talking to me respectfully and they're going, well, I currently earn this much money. I don't have to do too much, but I think me and my partners want to buy this out. And I'm looking at it going, are you fucking mental? You're telling me you're already earning 300 grand a year salary with bonuses. You've now been added on as a director with more responsibility. And you're telling me you want to then buy this piece away from another guy? Why? What more are you actually going to earn out of this?
Yeah.
We always say here's a balance between, you know, everyone wants to earn as much money as they want to. I understand that and I appreciate that. But you get to a point in life where a balance of happiness and earnings has to come into consideration.
Yeah.
And again, it's how much personal stress, strain and commitment you want to put into this. Because again, if you go back to what you're saying about the data, yeah, data's fine, but then banks want guarantees if you're going to do this.
Yeah.
And they said, whether or not you want to be able to put up your family home, you get other people giving you money.
That would really like, that'd be a difficult moment, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Like, did you go through this then?
Yeah. So obviously I've got to pay back the group over 5 years on the deal. I've got additional working capital loans for, as you're saying, to obviously take on that burden and cash flow needed. And then I've got personal guarantees against myself if it all goes to pot. So you tie that all up.
Yeah.
You're looking 1.5 million plus maybe of risk.
And how long till you've been through that and then it's like right now the upside?
Another three.
What do you have to do to get to the upside? Because
otherwise, yeah, so like you say, there's five-year payment plan. And as I say, so respectfully to the group, they've been very good. And I've never said anything negative about what happened, how we got it to this point. But it wasn't straightforward and easy. It took three brokers. And the thing that was quite awkward, which I would not even have thought about, was the middle ground where we had a project between us. We were supplying one set of resource to their project, but they had to be directly employed PAYE to deploy. They've all been there for quite a long time, nearly 30 of them, which meant when you're looking at redundancies, that would have been onto the business and things that people weren't taking consideration. So if it was all under the group HR and everything else on, say, day one, I've taken over day two. On day two, there's suddenly a fight or something kicks off or there's fraud found. That's then my issue. That's not their issue anymore. So same came into play, and there was a terminology of something called imputed knowledge, which was where this all kind of slowed up on certain things. And that's because we were taking resource from the group to then come and work directly for deploy. And what imputed knowledge means, which is will stick with me for the rest of my life, is basically, say, for example, you work for myself as my financial director, but you were the financial director for the whole group. If I sign away imputed knowledge, it means that everything is in your head I know about. So any contracts you've signed, any money you've paid out, anything that's happened, I'm saying that I know everything in your head. Which is impossible,
pretty much.
So when you are buying out from a group of businesses and you're taking staff from one or the other, we had to then take it down to responsibility over imputed knowledge. So if I've signed a document to say I agree to something, that's my problem. If they've signed it, that's their problem. But so it means when you're taking staff from one to the other, it meant that one person then wasn't 100% responsible for everything in their head. Because if you had a claim come out and it comes that you've signed a contract or someone then has signed a contract and you get sued, you've got no comeback. So you have to then worry about your warranties. I don't want to sound like it's a scary process, Sean, but I think a lot of people...
No, but it is. I think it's something... Especially, I think, like you say, there's different types of MBOs and different types of businesses and recruitment companies. You know, yours is highly, you know... You said the reason you went with them at the beginning is because of all the compliance that was involved. So, you know, you're trying to unravel that. It's going to add a lot more complexity in reality anyway. So, but the benefit to you is what? Like, why did you do this? Like, because it sounds like a lot of work, a lot of stress, a lot of personal guarantees. Why have you done it?
Sean, sure. I'm not going to lie. And I think, no. I think it's two types of people in life. You're either a leader or a worker. If you're a worker, absolutely fine. Just make sure you pick the right leaders. And I've always felt from day one, I'm good at leading things. I'm good with people. And I like to think I deliver on my own bullshit as much as I physically can.
Yeah.
And I believe in what we do. And that's, you know, blind faith is quite a lot in what we do. And I'm sure, like yourself, you know, I just saw you put a post up about your 7 years now. I flip it back to you. Why did you and Emma suddenly go, I think it's a great idea. Let's go and film a load of stuff in me flat and let's see if it works.
Do you know what? Yeah, it's that kind of feeling, isn't it, of like being in control of your destiny. I think that you can't have if you work for someone else. Like, you just can't. And like we had an opportunity last year to merge with another, I won't name them, but the well-known business. And it only literally got to the point of conversation. And it was quite exciting to begin with. And then me and Emma both were like,
nah.
Like, even the upside was what they were saying, like, you know, put the businesses together, you're going to get recurring revenue, basically permanent contract, you'll get multi. Yeah. It's not like you put two and two together, you get four, you get 10. It sounded amazing, but it meant that we would no longer be in control. And we would effectively be working with, there was like, you know, four or five leader, like shareholders on their side. And it just was like, you know what? We're happy. Like, we're building what we want in our way. You know, we could be bigger. Of course we could, but we're still, you know, building wealth and building a brand, and we're enjoying it. And well, why rock that boat? Like, until
you can't.
So yeah,
you can't. You great can't question learn to half flip these back. Things unless you experience it. Which means you can't. You know, I think there's a thing that came out the other day was there was risk small, win big, not risk high.
Yeah.
Win small. And I really like that. And if we look at since the buyout and things we've done, we've made adjustments to allow that to happen. And so the benefit from the buyout is that it gave us an opportunity to restart the business. You don't get a lot of opportunities to do that in business, especially in what we do, because we're always consistently on the hamster wheel. And when do we ever get the time to actually step off, to actually look at things properly and reconsider our kind of either life options or actual business options? And when you're going through this process, when you're going through due diligence, you then get the full list of your business costs. And that then gives you an opportunity to A/B, right? What are we paying now? What can we renegotiate?
Yeah.
So from a kind of lessons learned, again, if you're going to do an MBO, get them to give you every cost, every detail, line by line, with the contracts attached. So I think the funniest point of the deal was my sister phoned me up and went, we've got a problem. I'm going, okay, how big's the problem? You know, it's a really big one. I said, go on, hit me with it. You can't get rid of your photocopier for 5 years. If you want to see a contract that ties you in for the rest of your life, photocopiers in your office. Do not, anyone who's listening to this, sign a fucking photocopier deal. They are worse than Regis. And I thought Regis were the bane of my life for a period of time. But we now have to keep a relationship with the group for the next 4 years, because we cannot A, transfer the contract to our name, and B, we can't buy out of it.
Fucking photocopy. I don't even use paper anymore. I mean, everyone's business. No,
but we've got this thing sitting in the corner. That you...
If anyone needs the passport photo scanning or something, get you in touch with you, boy. You can sort it out.
We'll happily scan and send some things to you. You know, and that you know, it there were some funny upsides to it. So no, as real positives, we work with.
What were the symptoms then? Just quick question. What were the symptoms that were evident that made you think, well, obviously there's the personal desire to be your own boss and really own. I get that. And you put that back on me really well. But what was maybe evident from the partnership that you didn't feel you had that?
They didn't understand us. And we didn't understand them.
Hmm.
it was
right.
It was in the end chalk and cheese, because ultimately our industry is quite chaotic, where theirs is very planned to deliver and structured. Yeah. And you'd have conversations going, I don't know how you do your job. And they're looking at us going, I have no idea how you do your job. And I think in the end, it was just it was a mutual and natural thing that was always going to happen. So it is down to timing, and then ultimately as well, as you, I think you said, desire to do it how you see fit rather than how it's being done currently. I say there was nothing wrong with how it was being done. We were fine. We were making money. But then I think it kind of got to me again that it felt like being at my company before, where changes and things I wanted to put into place couldn't happen unless it was under my own steam. So, you know, silly things like I really wanted to bring apprenticeships into the business from day one, but from a larger group perspective, that potentially imported risk. Whereas from day one, when I took over Deploy, we've now got 4 apprentices in the business. One's just passed out and is still with us. So that was our first one, which is really exciting, really exciting. Because recruitment, and the same in your industry, it's really hard to keep young talent entertained and give them enough to do without them looking like a burden to the business. And in recruitment in general, unless you work for one of the big companies, no one gave you training. Here's your phone, here's your computer, go and make some money. And that was it. So it is still like that now. And this is where, I'm very passionate about engaging as much as we can with any age group to come into apprenticeships to give the education. I'm saying to young lads now and young ladies in the business, I'm saying, look, you will be telling us how to actually run a company. We've been blagging it for this long. We now need people to tell us how to do it.
So what is the future then? That leads us nicely into the final question. Like, what do you see as the vision for Deploy now that you've fully
took
over?
The vision now is to hire and bring in good people who want to be in a business that's not standing still. You'll never be bored working here. And whether that's coming in to be either a resourcer, a recruiter, working on our admin team or compliance team, we want just good people to come into the company. Expansion, I'm sitting in an empty office here. I've got 10 desks we're looking to fill in this office. We've got another 6 in Croydon, and we can flex down in Borden. So for us, it's all about growth, Sean, but sustainable growth within the client base and the industries we want to work in. America's, the final frontier for a lot of businesses. It is like the Wild West out there at the moment. And for me, that really interests me, that every state in America has a different rule, a different law, and a different way they're voting at the moment, or will be this year. So that really interests me, really, really intrigues me on how that can work and how we can operate.
We will do.
Ireland, Dublin's next on the roadmap. We've got a lot of work in Southern Ireland and Northern Ireland currently, and that will be for the next 5 to 10 years. He says, fingers crossed, touch wood. So Dublin would be next, and then America after that. But for me, it's looking at how we can streamline the day of our staff to allow them to be more proactive and outbound. I think a lot of people are worried about things like AI and automations. I look at it completely the other way, is that if I can take as much of the rubbish off people's days to allow them to actually get on with the job at hand, that's better than asking to still sit there plugging into databases and having to keep reviewing stuff that can be done automatically these days.
I think you bang on. I think my angle at the moment is people are they're overestimating what it can do and underestimating the damage it can do in certain areas. So if you think about your new business and new candidate acquisition, if you were banging out phone calls and getting nowhere, and then you were sending fucking hundreds of emails and getting nowhere, just using automation to hit 10 times more people is a stupid move. Because what you're saying is we're going to do more of what's not working and spend more money on it. Like, it's fucking bonkers. Like, you've got to think, well, what's the reason you're not getting the responses? Why are people not replying? where are these people hanging out? Like there's different thing. And that's what I always talk about. You know, obviously people voluntarily go to LinkedIn. At least 50% of people on LinkedIn go there every week. Why are they going there? They're not going for jobs. They're not going for your fucking DMs. They're going to be entertained. They're going to learn. They're going to be to connect voluntarily. Whereas they're voluntarily ignoring your emails. They're voluntarily switching your phone calls off. So like if you've got 5,000 or 10,000 connections and you're not doing anything with that, but you are thinking about automating all your email, like you're fucking, you're looking the wrong direction. And it's nuts. And how many emails do you get a day from automation saying quick question and all this bullshit? Like it's still awful. They're so bad. I actually just put them into spam now. Like I don't even give them that. They're gone forever. Yeah, some of these companies are blocked.
I get to it. So with my latest hire, I've now hired an EA just to take away my day-to-day chaos for myself and the other directors. Honestly, because ultimately the biggest problem with it is, as you say, you just get spammed all day. And I think because, I'm not getting younger. I'm not old, but I'm still not that young. I get anxiety over that number in my inbox. That's my biggest anxiety in my day is that inbox going up to 200, 300, 400. You know, poor Jackie, when she joined, I had 3,500 unread emails. 90% would be crap, Sean. 90% would be crap. But because I'm, we're trying to do so many different things, things get missed. And that's not me being ignorant or not looking at things. It's just, it's everything's so busy.
Well, you've only got a certain amount of energy in a day, and the founder's focus, founder's energy is so powerful. Like, that's one thing we've learned in the last couple of years at Oxo. We took our energy in the wrong direction for a bit, and we've moved it, and we've learned from that, and now we're feeling.
But it takes time, and it does take energy. It's not. We had some good time spending with yourselves, talking back to lockdown. That's when I did the personal branding training with yourself. And, that was a really well-timed piece because it allowed focus. Because the Western world was doing whatever it was, I had to keep myself busy. And consistently learning was something that will assist and push the business on. And then we worked with yourself on the branding from the buyout. And again, it all tied in and gave us a completely different view on life and how things to be done, So talking about the business back to ourselves, education and just learning on new techniques and ways of working is if you're not doing that and invest that in your business, what's the fucking point? You might as well sit on your own in your bedroom and do it on your own.
Yeah.
There's no point in hiring humans. Absolutely no point if you're not going to give them other ways of thinking, other ways of working. LinkedIn, it would always be there. It's always going to be powerful, but it's about the content you're actually putting out there. I mean, I bore people to death with my midlife crisis at the moment of DJing again, but hey, it's what I'm doing. It's a bit different. Again, it's just showing personality over business. I could talk business crap all day, but that's the whole point of having a business LinkedIn page, not my own page about what I'm doing and what I'm passionate about.
Love it. Paul, thanks so much, mate. What I'd love to do is get you back on again in a couple of years, see how you're progressing as an independent business now, as a privately owned business, and not being part of that wider group. If anyone's listened and has any questions about MBOs, whether it be structuring it from the side of wanting to exit and get their team to take over, or wanting to take over a business, or it might be anything else that we've mentioned. Are you okay?
100%. Lessons learned and knowledge is more powerful than trying to do it blind. So 100%, no problems at all. Happy to help,
mate. You're an absolute legend. You get Thanks, Sean. Back to your DJing.
Hey, look, in 2 years, I might have my teeth and hair done by then. That'd be my eyes done now. I'll go through the proper process.
I want to see you in curtains.
Man, I wish I could grow my hair. I think as I was 16, with curtains and an undercut last time. What a beautiful sight, right?
I don't know how I've ended up like a 90s boy.
Who cares? Go with it. Go with it. Thank you for having me on today, Sean. It's appreciated.
Paul, thanks. Thank you as always for listening to today's show. I truly hope that you got value from it. Honestly, it's the only reason I take time every week to ensure that my audience, you guys, future and existing recruitment owners, you're learning from each other
to make this industry that I love so much stronger. And today's episode is brought to you by my business, Hoxhelm. I'm the CEO and founder, and we're on a mission to help brand recruitment agencies and their people better. I want to help people have the tools to stand out in the most competitive markets in the world. We're currently working with over 350 recruitment agencies and 5,000 of their consultants right now, helping them to build their personal brands, to consistently win more business, attract talent, and just become that go-to recruiter in the market. Now, we do have a huge coaching program, but a lot of people don't know we also manage the brands of a lot of founders, and we can do the rebrand of that company organizational piece as well. So if your recruitment agency either needs help to look and sound exactly how you want it to, or your leadership and consultant level need to get out there and drive more traffic back to that website, to the business, and start using LinkedIn to generate more revenue, then you should definitely be reaching out to us. If that sounds of interest, please do visit www.hoxhelmmedia.com or drop me, Sean, a personal message on LinkedIn. I love hearing from RAG listeners. I would love to talk to you. Look forward to it. So I'll see you again next week with another episode. Catch you soon.